Welcome. This is Dr. Michio Kaku, Professor of Theoretical Physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, and this is Exploration. Every week on Exploration, we discuss the fascinating world of science and its impact on society. And today, leading off, we're going to summarize some of the top stories in science. Our top story today concerns the deteriorating situation between North Korea, South Korea, and the United States. The North Koreans have said that they will, in some sense, prepare for a preemptive nuclear strike, perhaps at the United States and South Korea. At the same time, the United Nations has passed sanctions against North Korea, and we are witnessing a tremendous escalation of hostilities. The question is it just a bluff, or is there some teeth behind some of the threats being made now that both North Korea, South Korea, and the United States are getting embroiled in a nuclear controversy? And then we're going to go into outer space. It turns out that not one, but two comets could light up the sky with a space spectacular. First of all, the comet of the century could come by later this year, perhaps in November, and perhaps October of next year, there could be a comet that sails into, get this, Mars. That's right, we could be witnessing an extraterrestrial impact, an impact that only takes place once every few thousand years if this comet slams into the red planet, perhaps October of next year. And then we're going to bring on our special guest today because we are talking about nuclear threats and, of course, the possibility of nuclear accidents. There's a book called Broken Arrow, which has perhaps the most voluminous information concerning all the different nuclear weapons accidents that has befallen the United States Air Force and military. So today we are talking about one of the hazards of the nuclear age, and that is that we do have nuclear weapons accidents. We drop them in, of all places, places like Georgia. We drop them in South Carolina. We drop them in the Atlantic Ocean. And what do we do with live hydrogen and atomic bombs that land on people's backyards? Well, let's just jump right into some of the top stories of the past week. The top story today concerns the increasingly deteriorating situation between North Korea, South Korea, and the United States, which is now involved with the United Nations. First of all, the United States and South Korea are conducting military exercises off the coast of the Korean Peninsula, which the North Koreans consider to be provocative. Now, we should say that the United States and South Korea have done this historically, so this is in some sense not new, and the North Koreans continue to say that this is an aggressive stance of the United States and South Korea. What's new, however, is the position of the United Nations. Because North Korea detonated another atomic bomb and launched a new intercontinental ballistic missile test, this angered the United States. And so the United States is pushing a resolution through the United Nations, which was just approved, which would increase sanctions on the economy of North Korea. Well, of course, the North Korean economy has already had quite a few sanctions on it, but it still persists in terms of building atomic weapons and missiles, and it's leading to a confrontation. And some people think that it could come right to the edge with both sides bluffing, and ultimately, the cards could be decided by China. China supplies 50% of the oil for North Korea, and also 50% of its trade, and some people think that ultimately China holds the cards. Well, first of all, let's take a look at the situation with regards to who has what. First of all, the North Koreans had a plutonium-producing reactor out of which they probably processed enough nuclear waste to build maybe 6 to 8 atomic bombs based on plutonium. Plutonium is the basic fuel that was dropped on Nagasaki. And so the United States and the United Nations think they have a pretty good sense of the capabilities of North Korea when it comes to plutonium bombs. However, the wild card in all of this is uranium. It turns out that in secret, North Korea was developing uranium plants by which, in principle, they might be able to create unlimited quantities of atomic bombs similar to the ones that devastated Hiroshima. The Hiroshima bomb was based on uranium, not plutonium, and we simply don't know. We simply don't know how much uranium in purified form the North Koreans have. So in other words, in principle, it could be possible that North Koreans have perhaps a dozen or several dozen atomic bombs like the Hiroshima bomb. The basic premise of the United States is that, well, the United States simply does not know of the total uranium capabilities of the North Korean government. However, when it comes to missile technology, there we simply turn on our radars and can see graphically precisely what the North Koreans have. The latest test of a ballistic missile was more or less a success, even though they had not been able to put a satellite into a perfect orbit. The missile did apparently fulfill most of its strategic objectives. It cannot reach the continental United States, however. Probably it could hit maybe Alaska. But you see, that's where we see some of the weak spots in some of the North Korean statements. In order to launch a missile with a nuclear warhead, you have to do several things. First of all, you have to make sure that the warhead works. That means testing it. Second of all, it has to be miniaturized, because atomic bombs are very unwieldy, large affairs. You have to miniaturize a thing so that it can be placed in the nose cone of a ballistic missile. And then once fired, you have to have gyroscopes. Gyroscopes that give you the reliability and the aim, because you don't want an atomic bomb to land in somebody's backyard. You want it to land on your strategic target. And that's where we see some of the weaknesses in what the North Koreans have. Even though the North Koreans are threatening a, quote, nuclear preemptive strike against Korea and the United States, most analysts would say that, no, Korea is not capable of hitting the continental United States. But the question is, at what point will it be able? It turns out that every few years when it conducts a test, each test is progressively more advanced than the previous test. And some people say that, well, hey, it's only a matter of time. It's only a matter of time before North Korea does perfect the capability by which it could hit the continental United States, but that's not happening anytime soon. Next, some analysts have said, well, we have an ABM system. We can shoot down North Korean missiles right out of the sky if they're aimed at the United States. Well, yes and no. People have beat their chest for many years saying that we have a primitive ABM system that can knock out North Korean missiles. However, no one believes that it's been tested. No one believes that it's foolproof. And it only takes one nuclear missile to evade your ABM system to really ruin your day. And so for all this talk about anti-ballistic missile systems that can shoot down North Korean missiles, well, seeing is believing. And at the present time, nobody believes that we have a 100% foolproof nuclear shield around the United States. Then the next question is, well, why doesn't the United States launch a preemptive strike? Well, there are military considerations that have to be taken into account. First of all, and this is the number one strategic disadvantage that the United States faces, Seoul, the capital of South Korea, is within perhaps 1 hour's worth of artillery range from the demilitarized zone, and the North Koreans have about a million troops lined up along the DMZ, and they could, within a matter of hours, reduce Seoul to a smoldering heap, because they have artillery aimed at the South Korean capital. So in other words, South Korea could be reduced to a smoldering ruin, not with nuclear weapons, but with conventional weapons aimed at the South Korean capital. And then if the United States wants to do something after hostilities begin, there's another problem. And that is, it could take weeks, months, before the United States could assemble enough troops to make any difference in the Korean Peninsula. At that point, most of the Korean Peninsula has already been made into a, quote, a sea of flames. So in other words, in terms of military strategy, the United States and South Korea are a distinct disadvantage because of the fact that the South Korean capital is so close, within shelling distance, of the demilitarized zone. Well, after all is said and done, what does all this mean? First of all, probably it means that North Koreans are bluffing. They don't have the capability to carry out their designs. And second of all, President Barack Obama has stated that it would be suicide. Suicide for the North Koreans to start a nuclear war with the United States. However, when all is said and done, perhaps the strategic implications of China have to be taken into account. First of all, why does China continue to support North Korea, even though the government there is basically hanging on by a thread? No one thinks that the people of North Korea are prosperous and well-fed. If anything, the average height of a North Korean child is actually a few inches shorter than a child in South Korea because of malnutrition. And so then the question is, what does China see in all of this? First of all, China sees things strategically much different than the way the United States views the situation. First of all, North Korea was a former ally. Second of all, it means that if the North Korean government does in fact collapse, inevitably it'll be unified under South Korea, and South Korea is close to the United States. And this is what China fears. China fears that the United States will have troops right on the Chinese border, which it considers to be unacceptable. And so China is faced with a difficult choice. On one hand, they don't want the North Korean government to collapse and have it absorbed by South Korea and the United States. But on the other hand, it also does not want to have to continue to maintain North Korea on life support, giving it 50% of food, 50% of energy supplies. It's a basket case, economically speaking, and it also besmirches the Chinese reputation. China wants one thing, and that is peace and stability so it can build its economy. What it does not want is a loose cannon out there like North Korea. However, we also have to look at it from the North Korean point of view. From the North Korean point of view, yes, it is a paranoid worldview. However, we also have to point out that during the Korean War, President Eisenhower didn't entertain plans to nuke North Korea. In fact, in the declassified documents of the archives of the United States government, we see clearly the war plans. The war plans that the United States had, which had an atomic annex. In the atomic annex, targets were chosen in North Korea for obliteration. In fact, President Eisenhower himself personally chose certain targets to be hit with nuclear weapons in case the conflict got out of control. So from the North Korean point of view, they say there is some reason for their paranoia. Well, let's hope cooler heads prevail in this conflict, especially China. We should also point out that this year and next year could be the year of the comet, fireworks in outer space. It turns out that there's a comet that's going to graze the Earth perhaps around November of this year. And that comet could be the comet of the century. It could even outshine the moon. And remember that even though meteors and shooting stars dart across the sky within a matter of seconds, comets can linger in space for days and weeks. And if it lives up to its reputation, this comet could be quite spectacular. And speaking about spectacular, there's yet another comet headed for Mars, the red planet. Collisions between celestial bodies is quite rare. Back in the 1990s, we had comet Shoemaker-Levy that plowed into Jupiter. However, this time there's a comet headed for Mars, which actually may impact on the red planet. Scientists at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory are elated at the possibility of a comet getting right close to Mars, which will be observed by our orbiters, plus the fact that there is a finite chance it will actually impact on the red planet itself. And this is what's sending the physicists and astronomers at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory to go to their computers to calculate precisely what the trajectory of the orbit will be. But if it lives up to its reputation, we could have a strike, a comet strike, on the red planet as well. So perhaps now is the time to dust off that telescope that you have in your attic or basement. Perhaps the time to brush off the telescope has come, because come November of this year, there could be a space spectacular right above your head. And now I'd like to bring on our two guests for today. They've written a rather astonishing new book, perhaps the first of its kind. Broken Arrow is the title of the book. Broken Arrow, the Declassified History of U.S. Nuclear Weapons Accidents. You have to do freedom of information. You have to get access to top secret documents in order to look carefully at the history of nuclear weapons accidents. When nuclear bombs were dropped on people's backyards, nuclear bombs were dropped on tourist towns, nuclear bombs were dropped in the Mediterranean and the Atlantic. Well, the full history with pictures is included in this remarkable new book. And we have two special guests, the authors Michael Magillette and James Oskins. We should point out that these are two retired military officials. They've had a long history with nuclear weapons. And while in the military, they had direct contact with nuclear weapons and heard about these broken arrows. So they decided to embark upon a journey to write perhaps the definitive story of what is known about nuclear weapons accidents. Also, we'll be using a certain amount of jargon, so let me explain. First of all, a nuclear weapon is set off with high explosive, conventional high explosives. So many times when the nuclear weapons were dropped on people's backyards or on a tourist town, the explosive went off, but not the nuclear material. The nuclear material itself is either uranium or plutonium, and it's contained in what is called the capsule. For a hydrogen bomb, which is 1,000 times more powerful than a uranium bomb or a plutonium bomb, there's an additional ingredient in the form of tritium gas. And so when you hear the words uranium, plutonium, tritium, you're talking about the active ingredients of atomic and also hydrogen bombs. But in these broken arrows, we have the conventional material exploding, but fortunately not the nuclear material. Also, these weapons have names associated with them. The Nagasaki bomb was mass-produced and became the Mark III. So during this interview, we'll be using the word Mark. Mark V, for example, was one of our early mass-produced atomic bombs. The Mark 17 is a hydrogen bomb, and so on and so forth, as we refer to these nuclear bombs. So once again, our two special guests will be talking about their new book, Broken Arrow, the Declassified History of U.S. Nuclear Weapons Accidents. The first question for you, Mike, is how did you get interested in the whole concept of nuclear weapons accidents?
Well, I was a nuclear weapons specialist in the Air Force from 1980 to 1995, and I retired in 95. And during most of my time in service, I had a big interest in the history of our career field. And after I got out, I decided I was going to create a web page and research some of the history. And in the process, I learned, of course, you know, a lot of this stuff wasn't public, and we had to do a lot of digging. And in the course of my research, we discovered that there were three Air Force specialty codes in the nuclear weapons career field. There was mechanical assembly, there was electronics, and there was nuclear components. And Jim happened to be a person who worked on the nuclear components, and he knew a chief master sergeant that I knew overseas. So from that point on, we're doing research for our website. We decided, well, why don't we write a book about broken arrows? Because we knew there's a lot of information coming into the public domain. And from that point on, we spent several years gathering information, requesting information, and the end result, of course, is our book, Broken Arrow, the Classified History of U.S. Nuclear Weapons Accidents.
Okay, and Jim, precisely how did you obtain this information?
Through a lot of correspondence with different government agencies. The information is not held by a single agency, unfortunately. We've contacted the Defense Threat Reduction Agency, the National Nuclear Security Administration, Department of Energy, Air Force Safety Command, Air Force Historical Research Agency, the National Archives, Department of Energy Nevada, U.S. Navy, U.S. Air Force, U.S. Army, a lot of correspondence and a lot of patience.
Okay. Now, let's get right into the whole concept of Broken Arrow. Some of these incidences have, in fact, gone into the public domain, but in a very sketchy way. you guys have compiled the largest and most complete set of information concerning these incidences. However, when I spoke in South Carolina once, people gave me some news clippings of what happens in 1958. It was Mars Bluff, Florence, South Carolina. A B-47 bomber dropped an atomic bomb on the Gregg family. The Gregg family heard this explosion. They went outside. The woodshed was blown apart. And later, the military came in and paid them off. Paid them off to keep their mouths shut about that incident. And, of course, to pay for some of the damage. And they also came in to bulldoze some of the soil. However, you got the goods. I just have some newspaper clippings. What actually happened in 1958 in Florence, South Carolina? Mike.
There was a B-47 aircraft that was flying at approximately 35,000 to 40,000 feet. And what apparently happened is one of the crew members, the aircraft was either carrying a Mark 6 bomb or we believe a... possibly a Mark 36 bomb.
And how does that compare with the Hiroshima bomb, by the way?
It was the Mark 6 basically was an improved Fat Man bomb.
Like the Nagasaki bomb?
Yes, a large implosion weapon. Basically an improved version of the Fat Man and the Mark 4. Or it could have been a Mark 36 early thermonuclear weapon, which required, of course, a capsule of nuclear weapons material. And during that time frame, of course, they kept the capsule separate in the crew compartment. We know that there was an inadvertent release, as they put it in the documentation. And, of course, the weapon dropped and impacted with the ground. And, when, of course, that happens, you have about 5,000 pounds of high explosive.
Now, it was the conventional explosive that detonated, right? We should make that clear. There's been no accidental nuclear detonation ever. But this was the conventional explosive that detonated.
Right. The early fission weapons and the early thermonuclear bombs had what was called a capsule, and this is kept separate until immediately before strike, or either a crew member had to go in and manually insert the nuclear material in the case of the Mark VI, or in the case of, say, later early thermonuclear types, it was already installed, but there was an electromechanical mechanism, a screwjack mechanism, to put it in. That the bomb commander could, just flick a switch. And, of course, now you mentioned, of course, the apparent lack of radiation. It is pretty interesting because those early bombs do contain a quantity of natural uranium in the tamper. So, yeah, there probably was some radioactive, real slight radioactive contamination, but the problem, I think, is it was in a swampy area, and in the case of, you mentioned Thule, when you have, like, water and, residual contaminants around, the survey instruments don't pick this material up.
Okay, and Jim, tell us a little bit about the cleanup operation. What happens when you drop an atomic bomb on someone's backyard and you have to go in and clean up the mess? Exactly what happens?
Well, it depends on the weapon. In that case, as Mike mentioned, there probably would be some residual radioactivity from the tamper, but the tamper was composed of what we now call depleted uranium, which actually is a very low-level radioactive element. In my career, actually, I worked on a lot of that. It's not very hazardous unless you ingest it. As far as cleanup goes, there's not much to it. The high explosive was more or less fragmented that. Just leaving it on the surface, basically, to be scooped up.
Now, it was mentioned that the bomb might have been an improved Nagasaki bomb. The Nagasaki bomb was a plutonium bomb. Plutonium is the most toxic chemical known to science. So is it conceivable that plutonium rather than uranium was released in that incident in 1958 in South Carolina?
No.
And
how's
that?
Plutonium would have been contained in the capsule.
Mm-hmm.
And the capsule was not inserted. The capsule was not on board the aircraft at the time.
Aha. So it was not fully loaded then when the bomb was dropped?
No, it was not.
So there was no danger of a real detonation taking place, but it was a broken arrow.
No, there was not.
I see. Okay. Now let's move on. You'd think that the military would have learned its lesson, dropping atomic bombs on people's backyards. Let's now talk about Goldsboro, North Carolina, where several hydrogen bombs apparently were dropped, according to the press reports. According to the press reports, every hydrogen bomb has safeties on them, four or five safeties. And all but one of the safeties on one of the hydrogen bombs was set off when its parachute was snagged on a tree, causing a jolt. And the jolt almost accidentally set off that hydrogen bomb, according to press reports. Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara indirectly referred to that incident, stating in public that there was one incident where we came very close to an accidental detonation of a nuclear weapon on the United States. Now, these are, of course, published reports. Tell us now what actually happened. Mike?
Well, the aircraft was flying an airborne alert mission. It was a B-52, and I believe that one was a breakup in midair. And what happened was the aircraft, the weapons, the Mark 39 weapons inside the aircraft were locked in the U-2 locking mechanism. Basically, it was like a bicycle chain wrapped around the weapon and held the weapon in the bomb bay. It was a rather primitive system, but I guess it worked under the circumstances. The aircraft broke up in flight, and in the process of it, you know, catching fire and breaking up and spinning out of control, the weapons were torn free from the bomb bay. And in the process, of course, the bomb rack separated from the shackle and the weapon, and of course it pulled the arming rod. Now, there's no electrical power applied to the weapon, but in the early days, in the early weapons, once you pulled, say, an arming rod, it activated a low-voltage thermal battery. And that started the chain of events. One of the weapons, of course, fell with a parachute, which is, I guess, pretty fortunate because it was recovered intact. And that's the weapon that, of course, they recovered with the parachute that's in the famous picture.
Well, I'm afraid that's it for the first part of Exploration. Once again, our special guests are Michael Magillette and James Oskins, author of a disturbing new book called Broken Arrow, The Declassified History of U.S. Nuclear Weapons Accidents. And if you want a copy of today's program, call the Pacifica Program Service at 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230 for a copy of today's program. And also be sure to dial into my website. It's www.mkaku.org. That's www.mkaku.org. So stay tuned now for the second half of Exploration. Welcome. Once again, this is Dr. Michio Kaku, professor of theoretical physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, and this is the second half of Exploration. In the first half, we began a discussion with Michael Magillette and James Oskins, author of a disturbing new book called Broken Arrow, The Declassified History of U.S. Nuclear Weapons Accidents. Did you know that nuclear weapons have dropped out of the bomb bay of crippled aircraft and landed on people's backyards? Did you know that we dropped four hydrogen bombs on a tourist town in Spain? Did you know that some of our nuclear weapons have been destroyed by lightning strikes? Did you know that an atomic bomb was dropped off the coast of Georgia, whose coordinates we know, and treasure hunters and thrill seekers have tried to identify, apparently, a live atomic bomb sitting on the bottom of the Atlantic off the coast of Georgia? Well, these are just some of the many, many Broken Arrow incidences that are documented in this disturbing new book, Broken Arrow, written by two military officers who had direct contact with nuclear weapons and information about Broken Arrows. Where we last left off, we were talking about the incident in Goldsboro, North Carolina, an incident where we came closest to a possible detonation. Of course, no detonation did take place, but there were two hydrogen bombs that were dropped when a KC-135 refueling tanker collided with a military weapon dropping these bombs. One bomb was snagged by a parachute. The other bomb hit the ground. And the question is, how close did we actually get to a possible detonation of a live hydrogen bomb in this Broken Arrow accident? Well, where we last left off, we were talking about the weapon that was snagged by a tree, but what about the weapon that hit the ground?
Now, the other weapon fell free fall, and there's a number of the mechanisms that, of course, were activated. Of course, as we mentioned, the arming wires were pulled. A pulse generator was activated. There's a number of other components, explosive actuators. There were timers, safety timers that have to run before other components are armed or activated. For example, there's barrel switches, there's inertial switches, high voltage thermal battery. And the final steps, of course, to detonate a weapon is, of course, you have to, what we call the X unit or the fire set has to be armed. And, of course, there's other components that are required to fire a nuclear weapon. For example, there's what's called a tritium reservoir. It contains a tritium deuterium gas, which is injected into the hollow pit of the weapon before it actually detonates. So there are still a number of steps that had to the weapon had to go through before it was could detonate in the nuclear sense. We mentioned the free fall weapon. That weapon fell to earth and it actually penetrated into the ground. It was basically, of course, destroyed. A telescope within itself and the secondary actually separated. In that case, the secondary, they estimate, probably went down about another 75 feet or so. They excavated the area. During the excavation, they actually recovered some of these components. And in the course of doing so, they recovered the arming switch. And it was destroyed when it hit the earth, but they thought at first that the arming switch had armed. Now, of course, that would be a great matter of concern. And Jim and I have gone through the reports, and we determined that there is actually another arming switch that had to be activated before final arming and firing. That was called the trajectory arming switch. And they actually, in documentation, they actually noted that there is probably a need for a trajectory arming switch for nuclear safety.
Okay.
But, you did mention that there was a lot of concern, and it was a serious incident. That can't be denied. I mean, it was a wake-up call as far as nuclear safety went.
Okay, so Jim now, could you summarize for us safeties? How many safeties, like a safety on a gun, how many safeties are there on a hydrogen bomb that you have to activate in order for the thing to detonate? And in this incident, exactly how close did we come to setting off all these safeties?
It depends actually on the weapon and when it was manufactured, the age and the development of the technology. There's probably, on that Mark 39, I believe there were seven safeties.
Mm-hmm.
Two of which did not arm. So there actually was little possibility that it would have detonated nuclearly.
So, in other words, there were about seven safeties. Five of them were set off, but two of them held, and that prevented any possibility of an accidental detonation. Is that right?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, it functioned as designed.
Uh-huh. And what did the military learn after that? This is probably the closest we've ever come, right, to an actual detonation?
That we know of, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay, now let's move on to 1966. This time we're going to go to Spain in an incident that was widely reported in the European press. This time, four hydrogen bombs fell out of the bomb bay when there was a KC-135 refueling tanker that collided with the military weapon. Four hydrogen bombs fell out. Three landed on this tourist town, and one landed in the Mediterranean. And it caused mass panic, mass evacuation, widespread coverage in the European press because there was a live hydrogen warhead sitting in the Mediterranean. And according to press reports, the military then sent the Alvin submarine, which is very famous because the Alvin submarine also went down to the Titanic and took those incredible pictures of the Titanic. The Alvin submarine reached out, located the fourth hydrogen bomb, reached out with its grappling hooks, grabbed the weapon, and missed. As a consequence, the bomb tumbled further into the Mediterranean, causing even more panic in this tourist town. Meanwhile, the military came in with trucks and began to cart off all the radioactive materials. One bomb had completely broken open and released its plutonium. Now, these are the press reports. Tell us now what actually happened. Mike.
Well, I guess the press is pretty much spot on when they're discussing, you know, the incident in general. But, of course, we have the classified documentation that discusses basically what happened to every single individual weapon. For example, you mentioned that, of course, the one weapon that fell into the Mediterranean, and of course, that was recovered after, I think, 2 months or more. That's interesting because I read a post-mortem report on that, and even at that depth, the seawater did manage to penetrate all into the weapon components and soak the high explosives and everything. So basically, the weapon, you know, couldn't have detonated. It was basically inerted in an explosive sense. The other weapons, of course, two weapons did land on the Spanish soil, and there was some plutonium contamination, and it was, of course, a very serious accident. We have reports of that that we're going to put in our next book. Basically, of course, we're going to expand on a lot of the accidents and introduce some new accidents. But there's a lot of interesting stuff. I guess we can discuss on Palomares. In fact, one of my friends up in Montana was actually involved in that accident. He was flying. He was the pilot of a KC-135, and he got a message to switch lead aircraft during the refueling. So that's a rather strange incident there.
And, Jim, could you elaborate on the cleanup operation? According to press reports, of course, widely covered in the European press. In fact, there's even a book about the Palomares incident. Many trucks had to come in to cart off large quantities of radioactive soil. Any comments?
Yes, that's true. There was a lot of, since two weapons detonated on impact with the soil, the high explosive in them detonated. Those weapons did contain a measure of plutonium, which, of course, is more hazardous than depleted uranium. And that's basically what they were cleaning up. I believe there were some tomato patches that were involved, a lot of people. Basically, the material was, topsoil was scooped off, put into containers, and sent back to the States. And buried.
And as I understand, correct me if I'm wrong, that fourth hydrogen bomb that fell into the Mediterranean that was reclaimed by the Alvin submarine is on display. In fact, I visited it. It's in the Albuquerque Atomic Museum. And as I understand, it has a dent in the front part of the bomb when the bomb impacted. And I believe it's on the cover of your book. Is that true?
Yes, it is. Yeah. The dent actually is in the material. It's a honeycomb material that's designed to absorb impact. And there's no bomb components actually involved in that area of the weapon.
Mm-hmm.
That was simply honeycomb material that collapsed.
Okay, now let's move on. We talked about South Carolina, North Carolina, Palomares, and now let's talk about Greenland. Just 2 years after the famous Palomares incident, this time we dropped atomic bombs on the ice in Thule, Greenland, and had to send in Huskies and other kinds of elaborate equipment to reclaim radioactive ice. Well, that's according to the press reports. Tell us now, Mike, what really happened in 1968 in Greenland.
Well, we had a B-52 from Plattsburgh Air Force Base, which I used to be stationed at, but of course not during that time frame. It was flying an airborne alert mission, and they had a fire in the cockpit, and they couldn't put the fire out. And they decided to head for Thule and hopefully make an emergency landing. Well, the situation degraded very quickly, and smoke was in the cockpit. Crew flew over the base. Actually, they actually flew over the base and ejected. And the aircraft kept flying for a little bit and started a turn. And approximately 7 miles from the base on the sea ice, the aircraft impacted. And we found some documents that indicate that the aircraft probably hit the sea ice at going over 600 knots, which I believe is approximately about 660 miles an hour. In that case, in the weapons it was carrying four thermonuclear weapons. In a, what we call a clip-in. And at that speed, I don't believe there's no chance at all that any weapon could survive an impact with a high explosive. Now, we do know from reading the documentation that I'd say with 100% reliability that all four weapons were destroyed. We know that from reading the documentation that they recovered four tritium reservoirs almost 2 miles from the point of impact. And like I mentioned before, you had that aircraft come in at that speed. Bam, hit the sea ice, say, at the, I don't know the down angle it was, but we know it was coming down pretty quick and at a steep angle, and we all know the force and physics involved when you hit something, you know, like you throw a football or a basketball on the ground, it's going to ricochet off, and that's exactly what those bomb components did. Now, there was some concern, of course, about maybe a weapon that maybe sunk through the ice or weapons. They actually released that in some press releases, and of course, given their experience in Spain, I don't think that would have presented a problem recovering any weapons that were under the sea ice at the time, because the depth of Volstenholm Bay was approximately 800 feet. But we do know, of course, we've actually reviewed all the message traffic that they declassified several years ago. It's about 300 pages, and they list all the components. We've actually got to have a chart in our new book that's going to list all the weapon components. It's all unclassified. So we can say with 100% surety that all four bombs were in fact destroyed. So there's no missing nuclear weapon in Thule.
Okay, Jim. Any more comments about this mess in Thule, Greenland? I'm sure the Greenland government wasn't too happy about the fact that they had all this radioactive ice. But any comments?
The key comment is, I think, the fact that even though the four weapons sustained a huge impact, they did not detonate nuclearly. There was no nuclear detonation. They were actually in a safe condition when the aircraft crashed. And the radioactivity was spread based on the detonation of the explosive in the weapon. And it did take quite a while to clean it up. I mean, they were working in conditions of minus 50 degrees in the dark. The Danes were concerned, but I don't think they were panicked about it. I don't remember reading anything to that effect. They were involved in the cleanup. I think the area is still being monitored. Basically, there was little risk, I believe, after the cleanup.
Okay, now, I was watching TV last year, and there was a special about an atomic bomb that was lost off the coast of Georgia. Mm-hmm. Now, I knew about that incident, but I didn't realize that it was actually part of the local lore. Local fishermen, local sea divers have been intrigued. The exact coordinates of the bomb that was dropped off the coast of Georgia, landed in the Atlantic Ocean, are in fact published. I have them somewhere myself. And in principle, if you had a little submarine, I imagine you can go down and dredge this murky water to actually take an atomic bomb out of the Atlantic Ocean. Well, according to the TV special, there were some people who thought about that, but the water is kind of murky, and the precise location, well, maybe it drifted over the years. But tell us a little bit about what happened off the coast of Georgia when an atomic bomb fell into the Atlantic Ocean.
I guess I'll handle that. Yes, the aircraft was on a simulated combat mission, in other words, an airborne alert mission. And we do know from reading the documentation that some others have attained through the Freedom of Information Act that it was carrying a Mark 15 Motto bomb, or Mod Zero, excuse me. And we noticed while reviewing the paperwork that there's a B in the AEC custody form and a C. And the C said 150. And I'm like, well, what's a 150? And we actually found a later document that lists all the nuclear capsules for each individual weapon, you know, that's a certain numerical number. And the Mark 15 Mod Zero carried a 150 cap. So, and it was written in the notation in the form that it was simulated. So the aircraft was in a collision. And, of course, they went to Hunter Air Force Base, tried to land the aircraft. The aircraft was severely damaged. And the aircraft commander decided that he wasn't going to risk the, exposing the base to a high explosive detonation, which was probably about 300 or 400 pounds of high explosives. So he decided he was going to fly out over to the near Tybee Island, Wausau Sound, and jettison the weapon. And that's what he did from a couple thousand feet. So we do have a Mark 15 Mod Zero bomb sitting out there somewhere without a nuclear capsule, in my opinion. And Jim could probably expand upon that more. He actually worked on the Mark 15.
Okay, Jim, any further comments about an atomic bomb in the Atlantic?
Yeah, the Mark 15 basically required the capsule to be inserted before it could be nuclearly detonated. The capsule was not aboard the aircraft. As a matter of fact, at that particular time period, the AEC, the Atomic Energy Commission, would not release capsules to the Air Force for flight. So there's no chance there was actually a real capsule in that weapon when it dropped. Even though some people contend there was, there certainly was not. The AEC would have not approved it. And that weapon is probably, they're estimating 25 feet down underneath the soft sandy bottom of Wausau Bay. The impact with the water probably dislodged most of the components in the weapon, but the case being 5 to 6 inches thick probably withstood the impact and penetrated the bottom. The high explosives in there at this point are probably nothing but sludge.
And it's probably all degraded, right? Because it's been sitting there on the bottom of the Atlantic for many a year. It's probably rusted through with water penetrating into its electronics,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, and the high explosive at this point, I'm sure, probably would not detonate.
Mm-hmm.
It's just sludge.
And so it's not nuclear armed, in other words. So
no.
It's just a basic high explosive, conventional high explosives in that bomb.
Yes.
But I guess any treasure hunter may want to find an atomic bomb casing at the bottom of the Atlantic. The coordinates are, in fact, published on the web.
Yeah.
Okay,
it's
moving.
It's an 8,000-pound relic.
Uh-huh. Now, moving on, your report also mentioned some incidences in Johnson Island with this Thor missile. Many Americans don't realize this, but we actually had an operational killer satellite program that was in principle capable of shooting down satellites. It was in fact operational, never really used, and now I think is mothballed. But I was surprised to find that there have been broken arrows in Johnson Island in around 1962. So, Mike, tell us a little bit about what happened at the semi-secret base in the middle of the Pacific, Johnson Island, where we had an operational killer satellite program that most Americans never read about.
I was actually surprised, too. The first I actually learned about this was in 1988 when there was a nuclear weapons researcher named Chuck Hansen who published his excellent book, U.S. Nuclear Weapons, The Secret History. And he mentioned some of the incidents in there. He didn't go into too much detail, which, of course, you know, always, for someone like me, you know, I have to research everything and get the answers for it. And eventually we located a document from the Field Command Defense Nuclear Agency that was declassified in 1983 or publicly released in 83, and it went into pretty good detail. We also located a film from the Department of Energy that covers Operation Dominic 1. And it actually shows the missiles on the launch pad. Of course, you know, they filmed all these things, and it actually shows it catching fire and blowing up, and or some of the missiles during the launch phase that were destroyed by the range officer when they went out of control. So we actually had four missiles that were destroyed in the vicinity of Johnson Island. First was on June 3rd, 1962. The next one was June 20th, 1962. July 25th, 1962. So, and the last one was October 15th, 1962. And, of course, those were significant incidences or accidents because actually in two of the cases there was plutonium contamination that fell onto Johnston Island and Sand Island. And we've uncovered another document just recently that shed some more insight into some of the components for one of the warheads.
And we should also point out that from Johnson Island, one Thor missile was successfully launched and detonated a hydrogen bomb in outer space. A first, it created an electromagnetic pulse. Of course, we didn't understand that at the time. It created an electromagnetic pulse that wiped out communication between San Francisco and Asia. And a new word entered our nuclear weapons vocabulary, the electromagnetic pulse. Complements of what happened in Johnson Island with the Thor missile that was fired into outer space. Jim, any more comments about missile accidents?
You had mentioned the anti-satellite Thor program.
Mm-hmm.
That actually was not related to the three accidents. They were separate.
Mm-hmm.
The Air Force was attempting to deliberately detonate a weapon at high altitude to see what effect it would have on the ionosphere. Obviously, the Thor missile was not as reliable as they hoped.
Mm-hmm.
And there are a number of other missile accidents. There was a Titan II accident in Damascus, Arkansas. In 1980, I believe, that actually the entire silo blew apart when the fuel in the Titan II was ignited by accident. That was quite spectacular. We have pictures. You would not believe the amount of damage that resulted when that missile detonated. The warhead was ejected from the silo and only suffered minor damage, but the silo itself was completely wrecked. The missile was wrecked. One person was killed. It was quite catastrophic.
Mm-hmm. And also, Mike, altogether, how many broken arrow incidences have you been able to catalog altogether?
At the moment, we've documented 36, and as our research continues, we find snippets of information that from, you know, declassified documents. For example, we know of two accidents, one in 1952 and one in 1956, where weapons accidentally fell out of the bomb bays of the aircraft. And we know the one in 1956, we actually have some details regarding that. We don't have all the details. We're still researching. But we know when the weapon fell, it was due to the safety mechanism and the sling, and when the impact of the weapon on the aircraft ramp actually damaged six detonators. That's a pretty serious incident.
So, out of these incidences, are there any that really stand out in your mind in terms of carelessness or lack of design or incompetence or just bad luck? Any particular incidences that stand out?
There's plenty of them. We got some declassified documents that cover basically the time frame from 1950 up to the late 60s, and there hundreds of incidents, say, due to minor personnel errors. That's going to be encountered. I mean, human beings make errors. There are a lot of serious incidents, which are called bent spears, result of, say, lightning strikes on weapons or missiles that were in the old days, in the early days, that were, you know, they just stood out in an open field in a facility. Of course, you got a giant lightning rod out there, and when you get hit by lightning, you could have some serious problems. We are taking a look into another, I don't know how many we want to estimate, maybe a dozen more broken arrows. We have to, you know, just wait for our documentation, and we hope to include it in our next book.
So there could be a lot more that we don't know about.
Well, actually, there's a recent one in 1988 that was publicly announced in Texas at the Pantex plant. It was a release of tritium gas from a weapon they were disassembling. They actually announced it to the press and notified all the congressional individuals, and you know they had their emergency operations center. And I don't recall ever hearing about it in the national press.
Mm-hmm. So. And in conclusion, we should emphasize once again that no nuclear weapon has actually been detonated in any of these nuclear weapons accidents. However, since the United States had 30,000 atomic and hydrogen bombs at the very height of the Cold War, you begin to realize that it was in some sense inevitable. That's the price that we paid. That's the price we paid for having so many atomic and hydrogen bombs in our arsenals. And just remember that the Russians had an equal number and probably even more nuclear accidents. Well, I'm afraid that's it for Exploration. Once again, our two special guests were Michael Magillette and James Oskins, author of a disturbing new book called Broken Arrow, The Declassified History of U.S. Nuclear Weapons Accidents. And if you want a copy of today's program, call the Pacifica Program Service at 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. And be sure to dial into my website. It's www.mkaku.org. That's mkaku.org. So once again, this is Dr. Michio Kaku for Exploration. Good day.